"What are you saying?" cried the baker, hiding his face in his hands. Tears sprang out from between his beringed fingers. But Joseph comforted him and said, "Do not grieve all too much, excellence chief baker. Neither do you dissolve, O master of the vine, in tears of joy. Rather accept with dignity what you both are and what comes to you both. For the world, too, being round, has an upper and an underside. Yet we should not make too much of this two-sidedness, for at bottom the ox is no better and no worse than the ass. They might easily change places, and together they make one whole. You can see by the tears you both are shedding that the difference between you two gentlemen is not so great. You, your eminence, master of the feast, be not prideful, for you are only good in the manner of speaking, and I suspect your innocence consists only in that nobody approached you from the side of evil, because you are a chatterbox, and they did not trust you, so you remained ignorant of evil. And you will not be mindful of me when you come back into your kingdom, although you have promised to. I tell you this beforehand. Only very late will you do it, when you stub your toe on the memory of me. When you do, then remember how I told you so. But you, Master Baker, do not despair, for I think you joined the conspiracy because you thought it was respectably backed, and you confused evil with good, as can easily happen. Lo, you are of the God when he is below, and your companion is of the God when he is above, and lifting up of the head is lifting up of the head, even though it be on the cross of Usir, on which, in fact, one sometimes sees an ass, in token that Set and Osiris are the same. Thus Jacob's son to the two fine gentlemen. But 3 days after he had interpreted their dreams, they were fetched out from the prison, and the heads of both were lifted up, the chief butler in honor, the baker in shame, for he was put to death. But the butler completely forgot Joseph, because he hated even to think of the prison, and so would not think of his former steward. Chapter 2. The Summons. Neb-Neph-Nezim. After these events, Joseph remained for 2 more years in the prison and his second pit. He had reached the mature age of 30 when he was hastily removed. Yes, in the most breathless haste, for now it was Pharaoh's self who had dreamed. After the space of 2 years, Pharaoh had a dream. In fact, he had 2 dreams, but since they came to the same thing, we may speak of them as one. The point is idle by comparison with another, namely, that when we now speak of Pharaoh, the word has no longer, in a personal sense, the meaning it had when the chief baker and the chief butler dreamed their true dreams. For Pharaoh is always the word, and Pharaoh is always. But at the same time he comes and goes, just as the sun is always, yet likewise goes and comes. So now, that is to say, very soon after the two gentlemen, Joseph's protégés, had in opposite ways had their heads lifted up, Pharaoh had gone and come. This had happened, and much else besides, and Joseph had missed it, while he still lay in prison and in bore, and only a faint echo of the resounding event reached him, namely, the change of reign, the lamentable passing of one day of the world and the exultant dawn of another, a new time, from which men expect a change for the better, no matter how good, humanly speaking, the former one may have been. On that day, they think and believe, right will drive out wrong. The moon will come right, as though it had never come right before. In short, from now on, life would be one long season of laughter and amaze, all of which was reason enough for the whole population to hop on one leg and drink to excess for weeks. After, of course, a period of mourning in sackcloth and ashes, and that was by no means a hypocritical convention, but sincere grief over the going hence of the old time, for man is a creature prone to confusion. As many years as his chief butler and the general intendant of his bakeries had spent days at Zawi Re, namely 40, had Amun's son, the son of Tutmosa, and the daughter of Mitanni's king, Neb-Maure Amenhotpe III, Nemuria, adorned his throne in splendor and built his palaces. Then he died. He united himself with the sun, having had, at the close of his life, the disheartening experience with the 72 conspirators who had sought to lure him into the coffin. But now, of course, he had come to it anyhow, and a splendid coffin it was, studded with nails of pure beaten gold. He lay there, preserved in salt and bitumen, made to last to all eternity with juniper wood, turpentine, cedar resin, styrax, and mastic, and wrapped in 400 ells of linen bandages. 70 days it took till the Osiris was ready. Then it was laid on a golden sledge drawn by oxen, that carried the bark, holding the lion-footed bier roofed over by a canopy. Preceded by incense-bearers and water-sprinklers, and accompanied by a host of mourners, apparently overcome by grief, it was borne to its eternal dwelling in the hills, a many-chambered tomb equipped with every convenience. Before its door, the ceremony was performed, the so-called opening of the mouth, with the foot of the Horus calf. The queen and the court were no longer walled in within the many-roomed abode, there to starve to death and moulder beside the dead. The days when that was considered necessary or proper were far in the past. The custom had lapsed and was forgotten. And why? What had they against it? And why was it remote from every mind? They indulged their fill in primitive observances, diligently made magic, stopped all the body openings of the exalted cadaver with charms against evil, and faithfully performed the ceremony with the calf's foot instrument, according to the time-honored ritual. But to wall up the royal court? No, none of that. It was not done any more. It was not only that they did not wish to do it, that they no longer found it a good idea, as once they had. They did not even want to know that the custom had ever been practiced or found good. Neither the traditionally walled-in parties, nor the wallers-in, gave a single thought to the matter. Obviously, it could no longer bear the light of day. Call that light late or early, as you will. And that is remarkable. Many people might feel that the remarkable thing was the fine old custom itself, the immurement of the living. But surely it is more remarkable that one day, by common, wordless, indeed unconscious consent, it simply ceased to come under consideration. The court sat with its head on its knees, and all the people mourned. Then they all lifted their heads, from the Negro borders to the delta, and from desert to desert, and greeted enthusiastically the new epoch which should know no more wrong, in which the moon would come right, lifted their heads in exultant welcome to the son and successor, a charming though not beautiful lad, who, if the reckoning was correct, was only 15 years old, and still under the wardship of Ti, the goddess widow, Horus' mother, who was still for some time to guide the reins of state. He was throned and crowned with the crowns of Upper and Lower Egypt, and there were great celebrations, in much weighty pomp, partly in the Palace of the West in Thebes, but the most solemn part at the place of the coronation, Per Mont, whither young Pharaoh and his lady mother, lofty in feathers, with a splendid retinue, on the heavenly bark, star of the two lands, betook themselves upstream amid loud shoutings from the banks. When he returned thence, he bore the titles Strong Bull, favored of the two goddesses, great in kingship in Karnak, golden falcon who lifted the crowns of Paramount, king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Nefer Keperu Re Wanre, which means lovely of form is he, who alone is, and to whom he is the only. Son of the sun, Amenhotpe, divine ruler of Thebes, great in duration, living to all eternity, beloved of Amon-Re, lord of the heavens, high priest of him, exulting in the horizon by the power of his name, heat which is in Aton. Thus was young Pharaoh called after his crowning. The combination of titles, Joseph and my Sakme agreed, was a compromise arrived at after long and tough bargaining between the court and the temple power. For the court inclined to Atum Re's complacent sun sense, whereas Amun's jealous and oppressive temple power had reaped a few low bows before the traditionally highest, but only in return for pretty transparent concessions to him at On, on the point of the triangle. The royal boy, actually consecrated as greatest of seers of Re Horakhte, had even woven the un- and anti-traditional doctrinal name Aton into the trailing garment of his title. His mother, the goddess widow, called her strong fighting bull, who of course had no faintest resemblance to a bull, quite briefly Meni. But the people, Joseph heard, had another name for him, a tender and delicate name. Neb-Nef-Nezem, it called him, Lord of the Breath of Sweetness. It could not definitely be said why. Perhaps because it was known that he loved the flowers of his garden and liked to bury his small nose in their fragrance. Joseph then, in his pit, missed all these spectacles and the accompanying hubbub of rejoicing. The only sign of them down in the prison was the fact that my Sakme's soldiers were allowed to get drunk 3 days running. Joseph was not present. He was not, so to speak, present on earth when the day changed. Tomorrow became today, and the son of tomorrow the son of today. He only knew that it had happened, and from down below he cast his eyes up to the sun. He knew that Neb-Nef-Nezim's child and sister bride, another princess of Mitanni, whom his father had wooed for him by letter from King Tushratta, had disappeared and taken her way westward almost as soon as she had arrived. Well, Meni, the strong fighting bull, was quite used to such disappearances. There had always been much dying all about him. All his brothers and sisters had died, some of them before his birth, some since, among them one brother. Only a late-born little sister had survived, and she too had shown such a strong inclination westwards that she was almost never seen. Nor did he himself look as though he would live for ever and always, to judge from the sandstone images which the apprentices of Ptah made for him. But it was imperative that he should continue the line of the sun before he too went hence. So he had been married again in the lifetime of Nebmari Amenhotep, this time to a daughter of the Egyptian nobility, Nefertiti by name, who had now become his exalted consort and mistress of the two lands, and to whom he had given the radiant title Nefer Nefru Aton. Beautiful beyond all beauty is Aton. Joseph had missed the wedding feast, too, and the sight of the rejoicing crowds on the banks. But he knew about it, and he took note of the young highest. He heard, for instance, from my Sakme, who got to know a good deal in the course of his duties, that Pharaoh, directly he had lifted the two crowns at Paramount, had given the order to complete with all speed the building of the house of Re Horakhte Aton at Karnak. His departed father had in fact already commissioned it, and special order was given to erect in the open court of the temple a mammoth freestone obelisk on a lofty base. The sun meaning of this obelisk, referring to the doctrines of On at the point of the triangle, was quite obviously a challenge to Amun. Not as though Amun would have had anything against the neighborhood of other gods, in and for itself.